The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
It's really exciting how the marriage relationship can grow and develop and become better as the years go by, and many of us here know that. And soon after I was first married, back in 1952, I had the feeling that I had reached the pinnacle of sexual pleasure. And yet, 7 years later, just not too long before my first husband passed away, I remember remarking to him, "Honey, you know, the amount of pleasure that I knew at first was nothing compared to the depth and length of my response now." 7 years and 2 babies later. And I thought it was just because we'd worked together on lovemaking and had learned one another's responses and had cultivated this area of life. And I found out that that was true. But then I read an article in the Reader's Digest that threw further light on the subject. It said that a woman's sexual life is something that develops and grows as her whole sexual nature is functioning. That means that the pregnancies that at the moment may seem to cut down sexual desire, and the childbearing, and the nursing of the child, and the whole process that's involved in a woman's sexual nature, that as these processes go through slowly and imperceptibly almost, they bring a woman's response into fuller bloom. And then when I married Warren about 4.5 years ago, you know, I rather felt like an old pro. But I found that after 8 years of being a widow, that I had to again go through a period of reawakening and adjustment to a new partner. And I, in the early months, I had some struggles. I had some silly fears, and one of them was, once in a while, I'd go through a little period of time when my desire would lessen. And then I had that panicky feeling. Is that permanent? Well, you know, it wasn't. This is just a fact of life that we don't feel the same all the time. But we do face fears in the area of the sex. But as time went by, I found that new and unexpected delights began to appear. There were some things that I heard were possible in women's responses, but I just knew I would never feel that or be that. Respond that way, and unexpectedly, they began to come. And it seems that it's really exciting that we grow in this relationship. We don't reach a plateau. And Charlie Shedd, in his book, one of his books, the one to Letters to Philip, made the statement that he called lovemaking the 20-year warm-up. And to express the idea that as the years go by and the coming together of the couple to express their love and oneness can grow in wonder and delight. But as I said, this rarely happens without facing and resolving problems. And we have a large group of women here this morning, and I'm sure that we have a large variety of problems that you're facing in your sexual life. There may be some of you who are not conscious of any problems. You have a deep, delightful relationship. And even there, I think that we can grow further as our understanding increases. And others may actually, the sexual part of their marriage may be almost non-existent or basically frustrating. And some others may have had a relatively normal sex life and then suddenly, maybe about in their 40s, the warmth and closeness disappeared and some basic problems cropped up. And maybe they're even afraid to communicate with their husbands on them and just alone in anxiety. And then there are others who are just sort of beginning your sexual life and you've experienced some of the delights and probably disillusionments of this area of life, or maybe both. But whatever the case, I believe it's possible for us to grow and develop. And I feel that I was impressed recently from an issue of Newsweek that said that sexual problems of one kind or another affect at least half of the married couples in the U.S. today. So problems are normal. We don't have to panic. because this area is not automatically all that we had hoped it would be. I believe that it's true, something that I read, that says that the most important sexual organ is the brain. And it's the mind is the part of us that exerts the ultimate control in the sexual response. And therefore, we're going to take some time this morning to consider some basic concepts that can help our minds to send down more faithfully some go-ahead signals to our bodies. And the article that we offered for you to sign up for is basically going to be about the most important sexual organ and ideas as to how to train our minds to bring us to a greater fullness in the sexual relationship. But there are things that we forget about sex or maybe never knew, or basic concepts or misconceptions that need to be cleared up. And we'll take a little time this morning on these. And first of all, sex is God's idea. Sex is not a chance arrangement in an impersonal universe with no personal infinite God. Sex is not the invention of 20th century Hollywood. It's the creation of the eternal and loving and holy God. In Genesis 1, verse 27, we read, "So God created man in his image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them." Male and female, with all the functions and needs of their bodies, he created them. And then in verse 31 we read, "God saw that everything he made was excellent indeed." So sex is a God-created and a God-approved experience. And it's important for many reasons. God made man different from the animals. With the animals, it's basically for procreation. And that's one of the important functions of sex for human beings. But the meaning of sex for human goes far beyond that. And the physical relationship in marriage is part of the many faceted ways in which a couple express and develop their loving relationship. So it's, for one thing, it's the legitimate avenue for the satisfaction of the sexual drive sex in marriage is. But it also has vital emotional and psychological and social purposes. And it gives a sense of fulfillment and security. The security of giving and receiving love. The security of meeting needs and of having our needs met. The growth of personality, a healthy sex life helps to blossom our personalities as one means to this. And it plays an important part in improving the social nature of the family. The children need an environment in which husband and wife are deeply devoted one to another and happily related to one another. And a healthy, normal sex life promotes that environment for growing children. So it has many reasons, and it's basically a physical act, but it draws much more into it than just the physical. And it's a powerful influence in a marriage. But besides that, it's fun. It's easy to over-philosophize on sex and to describe it in such holy, sacred, transcendental terms that we forget that it's fun, that one of the primary purposes is emotional and physical pleasure. And one young teenage girl remarked that she sort of had the idea that sex was so wonderful and so sacred that you really shouldn't enjoy it too much. And she was relieved when she heard a lecture on sex that where the older woman admitted that sex is fun. Sex is a gift from God, and we worship a God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. We read in 1 Timothy 6:17. And God wants us to enjoy the gift that he has given. But he has also placed some restrictions upon it. He hasn't just given total sexual freedom. And Maurice Wagner, a counselor at the Naremore Clinic in California, speaks of the fact that God is loving and he is restricting. And because he loves, he gives restrictions, just like a wise mother restricts a child from playing in a dangerous street. And God's laws are always given in love. And his restrictions are a wall, a protective wall, to keep us from dangerous areas where there are hidden mines that may explode. But we cannot see them ahead of time, but they can destroy us. And Mr. Wagner went on to say that this is what we do. We say, I want to go that way, and our desire controls us. And we start walking that way, and we come to a wall, and we say, take that wall down, I want to go that way. And God says, now that wall is to protect you from getting out in that minefield and being destroyed. Oh, the wall is my friend. You know, I changed my mind. I think I'll go this way. And God places restrictions upon our privilege to maintain the value of the privilege. It's like talking. God gives us liberty to talk. Talk all you want, but he gives us some rules. Don't lie. Lovingly give other people a chance. Other restrictions. But the thing is, talk all I want, but if I disregard those rules, I lose my audience. If I talk all the time, if I tell lies, pretty soon I lose my audience. I lose my privilege. I, in a sense, destroy myself. And that's partly what the Bible means when it says the wages of sin is death. It's destructive. It's not life-giving. And then we, from this background, Mr. Wagner proceeded to the subject of sex, and he says, sex is an interesting privilege granted to all mankind. And God says sex is for marriage as an expression of love. In marriage, he gives no particular sex limitations or restrictions. But outside of marriage, he gives no privilege, and he's very rigid in this. And when people violate God's law, disease sets in, or mental attitudes arise that destroy the value of the sex act itself. When our sex drives are scattered to various lovers, they become a passion that burns but is never satisfied. And the more our sex drive is scattered, the less satisfaction and the greater the compulsion to find satisfaction. So in God's pattern in marriage with love, sex has a wonderful purpose. But when we violate God's law, we pay a price. The wages of sin is death. We begin to destroy ourselves in one way or another. And a brochure that accompanied a jar of common cold remedy said, for best results, follow the instructions of the maker. And this is true of sex. God encloses sexual activities within a framework that provides the greatest security and the greatest freedom and the broadest satisfaction for both partners. And that framework is marriage. And I love that little article we put at the end of your notes. Don't look now. On this minister's wife speaking out, give me the freedom of the marriage bed. And it's challenging and exciting to just realize our privilege of having the protective area of marriage in which to develop in this area of life. Well, then we might go on to say, what are God's absolutes and ideals? And I've recorded there a few scriptures for you. The Bible speaks out honestly and frankly about sex. And God forbids adultery. And adultery means sexual relationships when one of the partners is married to someone else. He forbids fornication. That's when two single people have sexual relations without being married. And he commanded in Mark 10:19, do not commit adultery. And in that 1 Corinthians 9, he said, do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor greedy. And he lists other kinds of sin shall inherit the kingdom of God. Shun immorality. He's strict in this because he loves us, just like a loving mother takes a sharp knife from a little child. And Paul Tournier is an eminent Swiss physician and psychotherapist. And he says, of course chastity is possible. And he says its effect is infinitely tonic for both physical and moral health. It is in order to justify its conduct that the world maintains the contrary. And he goes on to say that the Christian values so highly this instinct put within them by God, and they have such a positive attitude towards sex as one of God's masterpieces that they do not want to abuse it, and they submit it to God. Now, another of God's absolutes is purity of thought and speech. And it's interesting, as you really experiment or find out the effects of impure thoughts in your own sex life, I think that you'll find what I have. I'm tempted sometimes, when my sexual arousal does not come so quickly, I'm tempted to let my mind go to impure thoughts. There's an initial stimulation about them, but when I do, my climax is never as deep and satisfying. There's something in our makeup that responds to God's patterns. And God prescribes purity of thought. And in Matthew 5:27, Jesus said, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And there's the principle of psychological acceptance that's involved. Actually, impure thinking is a source of immorality and promiscuity. We may think, I would never be unfaithful to my husband. But I would wager that many of us here have been tempted. And the principle of psychological acceptance says that if you keep going over and over an act or a temptation long enough in your mind, then given the proper opportunity, you will perform the act. So pure thought is important for our well-being in many ways, and it's closely related to purity of speech. And Ephesians 5:4 says, dirty stories, foul talk, and coarse jokes, these are not for you. And these are high standards. They're attainable if Christ is living in us to give us the power and to lead us on to something better. But God's ideal goes further than a few restrictions. His ideal is perfect freedom and delight in marriage. And the Bible has many places that speak of the delight and freedom of marriage, of sex in the marriage relationship. Proverbs 5, look it up sometime. And at first it warns strongly against promiscuity. And then it gives a beautiful positive instructions about how sexual needs can be met. And it speaks of primarily to young men because they were the ones that were freer to be tempted in those days. Today it could speak to men and women equally. But it speaks of the wife as being a cistern or stream of water, of running water, and that the husband's sexual thirst should regularly be met in sexual experiences with his wife. And a free translation of verse 19 would say, let your wife's love and your sexual embrace with your wife intoxicate you continually with delight. Always enjoy the ecstasy of her love. Sounds like God means deep enjoyment in marriage. You say, well, that's primarily talking to the man. But 1 Corinthians 7, verses 2 through 5, recognizes both the man and the woman's sexual needs equally. And it shows also that each partner is to meet the sexual needs of the other. And that an enjoyable, active sex life is consistent with a devout spiritual life. Let me read it quickly in a free translation given by Herbert Miles in his book, Sexual Happiness in Marriage. Because of the strong nature of the sexual drive, each man should have his own wife and each woman should have her own husband. The husband should regularly meet his wife's sexual needs, and the wife should regularly meet her husband's sexual needs. In marriage, just as the wife's body belongs to her husband and he rules over it, so in marriage the husband's body belongs to his wife and she rules over it. Do not refuse to meet each other's sexual needs unless you both agree to abstain from intercourse for a short time in order to devote yourselves to prayer. But because of your strong sexual drive, when this short period is passed, continue to meet each other's sexual needs by coming together again in intercourse. Now, those are practical instructions, and they put men and women on an equal par as far as basic ability to enjoy the sexual act. God's approval of sexual pleasure may be as most vividly portrayed in the book Song of Solomon. It's near the center of our Bibles. And it has delightful spiritual applications to the Christian's relationship with Christ, but primarily it's a picture of married love. And it is a beautiful love poem, and it reveals the intimacies of marriage. And in poetic and vivid but unoffensive language, it describes the physical bodies of the married lovers and reveals their feelings and attitudes and imaginations and joys, and it even now and then tells a little bit about the frustrations of the wife. And I would suggest that you read it. And if it seems out of place to you in a holy book, then your thinking is more prudish than God's is. God puts his wholehearted approval upon sex in marriage and wants us to enjoy it. But let's go on to some common misconceptions and unrealistic goals. Often we fail to reach our potential in marriage because of misconceptions. And many misconceptions center around the importance of sex. In our society, it tends to be overrated. Actually, sex is not the most important aspect of marriage. Just as food and sleep are not the most important things of life, and yet if you're deprived of either, that's all you can think about. And so if a person is deprived of sex, or it's not satisfactory in the marriage, then it looms to large proportions and becomes foremost in importance. But if sex is kept in balance and the relationship is good, sex maybe is about 10%, and out of balance it becomes 90%. So if our husbands are overly, overly preoccupied with sex, it may be that we could learn some things that would bring them to balance in this. Larry Christensen, in his book, The Christian Family, says that sexual problems are, says that time-wise, the sexual union occupies a relatively small space in marriage, even for newly married couples. Yet, he said, that union is essential to marriage. It's like the spark plug of a car, small but essential. It sets the whole mechanism in motion. So it's important, but it's not the most important thing in life. Then about the nature of sex. If we omit from the universe a personal, infinite, loving God, and if we believe that life is simply the chance unfolding of matter with no planner, no designer behind it, no one giving it purpose, then essentially sex becomes like it is in an animal. Man is just a part of the machine portion of the universe, and his sex drive is there to be fulfilled anyway and any time. And it's just an expression of an instinct. And this takes away, when it's carried to its logical conclusion, moral values and standards and meaning from the sexual act, the depth of meaning that God meant it to have. But the opposite view is an ascetic view that sort of views sex as a necessary evil. The body is evil. Fulfill its functions as quickly and get it over with, or it's sort of impure. Now, we don't find any spokesman today for this view. No one would be caught defending Victorian prudery in this day. But often our conscious mind accepts that sex is good and right and pure, and the unconscious mind clings tenaciously to old patterns of thinking that have been built into us over many years. And so the unconscious attitude that sex is evil grips many people, and this causes problems in marriage. And there are ways to expel and to change these patterns of thought. Now, we also need some further information about responses and needs, both women's and men's. Many times, misunderstandings about women's sexual responses cause utter frustrations. And we live in a sexually supercharged society where the young people grow up seeing the models and advertisements and the heroines in the novels and sort of get the idea that every normal woman is utterly passionate, just like sort of a passion flower waiting for the husband to come along and unfold its petals. And many Janes and Johns expect that once they're married, their premarital inhibitions will vanish and will disappear, and except for a few unfortunate women that they call frigid, they will be earthy and passionate. And they get married, and that's just not the way it starts out. And many times this causes frustrations. The wife feels inadequate and fears that she's undersexed, and the husband, she's afraid the husband will think that he got a bad draw, and it really causes problems. But on the other hand, some people believe that female sexuality is weaker than male sexuality, and actually some believe that sexual enjoyment is largely for the male. This is the other swing. And actually, it's risky to generalize about the nature of women's responses because we're so unique. And you have to do what I do in the marriage manuals and the books. I get great help from them, but I discard some things. And some I discard after a long time of believing them and finding that they're just not true for me. But I think it's good. We can put a few general statements. It appears that most husbands and wives do not have equal sex drives. In fact, it's reported that less than one-third of married women can match their husband's sex drive. And this many times evens off over the years, so that sometimes as middle age or past comes, the woman's drive may even exceed the man's in some cases. But the usual thing, especially at the beginning, is that the husband has far more interest in the sex act than the woman. And for the woman, another thing is that generally for the woman, sex is more all-inclusive. She's not as preoccupied with the act itself. She considers sex, like one young girl bride put it, I had sort of thought that it would begin with tender words in the morning and then continue through the day with thoughtfulness and the warmth of loving caressing and throughout the day, and then it would explode in bed at night. And she was disillusioned because she didn't get the tenderness throughout the day. And it's true that for a woman to come to her fullest sexual response, her love relationship has to be couched in the day-by-day tenderness. A woman's sex is a social relationship, basically. And she has to have social intercourse with the man before she can, as fully as she was meant to, have sexual intercourse. Now let's consider a few more misconceptions. One is that a woman must have orgasm or climax to enjoy sex. And there, it's not true. I'm not saying that it's not ideal for women to climax, but there are many women who either never or do not regularly climax who really look forward to the sexual act because of the tenderness and intimacy of the warm embrace and the feeling of belonging and the pleasure of giving pleasure. And some who cannot respond totally still find it intriguing and exciting. There's another misconception that says it's harmful for a woman to be sexually aroused without climax. And I believed that for many years, quite a few years. In my first marriage, 3 or 4 years, we worked under that premise because it was taught so clearly in the marriage manuals. And so we would work and work and work. Take a long time, and usually we were able to bring me, but it was so much work. I tried so hard. Frustrating. And later on, we just began to face facts. My husband's sexual drive was stronger than mine. He needed this delightful release more often. And if I would just say, honey, I think that either I'm too tired or we just don't have time right now for both of us to come, but I would love for you to have the pleasure. I feel you need it right now. And so we would have the sexual act. And at that time, I did it carefully, keeping myself from turning on or feeling anything, because I still believed what this said. But you know, years later, in fact, in my second marriage, I found out, amazingly, if I just entered in wholeheartedly, just, you know, would say, honey, let's just concentrate on you and not work on me today. But I wholeheartedly entered in. In fact, it was in a situation like that that for the first time I climaxed without any special attention to me at all in foreplay. And it began to open up just a whole new area of enjoyment in sex for me. So I think we have to realize that it's not harmful sexually for a woman to be aroused. Sometimes maybe she should not be aroused. But sometimes I find that if I don't... In fact, I come almost all the time since we hit on this. But sometimes if I don't, it just sets me up for next time. And it's not frustrating unless I expect it to be. And there are times when we, like during pregnancy, when our desire may be less, but our husband still has his needs. And some of these misconceptions can cause hours of wasted time and frustrations. Make a man feel like he's less than a man if he can't every time bring his wife to climax. Another misconception is that low orgasm women are more tense and irritable than high orgasm women, and this has just been proved not to be true. And another misconception is that women who have not achieved climax or even enjoyment are hopelessly frigid. And I don't believe that's true. I believe that it's a rare thing for a woman to be what we call frigid, and I don't like to use the term even. I use the term sexual impairment instead. Something that almost always something can be done about it. And frequently, marriage counselors will report that frequently couples after 2 or 10 or 20 years when the wife is not climaxed have learned how to bring her to a full response. Herbert Miles, whom I referred to before, reported that 10 to 12% of married women in our society do not achieve orgasm. So if you do not, you're not a freak. There are lots of women like you. But most likely something can be done about it. I think that the desire of the Creator for women to enjoy the sexual act is shown in the way He made the body. He didn't just provide bodily parts that are essential for reproduction. He provided in the pelvic genital area rich supplies of nerve endings capable of receiving sexual stimulation. And in fact, He gave her one organ, the clitoris, which is the only purpose it has is to arouse her sexually and bring her to climax. Now, I believe that God intended for almost all women, that it's possible for most women, if they really want to learn to achieve this. And we're going to be considering ways in which we can progress. In some women, the sex drives emerge very easily, and others it takes longer for them to come to the surface. Conceptions about men's sexual responses that cause problems in marriage. Women often misunderstand their husband's intense sexual drives. Sometimes they forget that, especially early in marriage, the man has a reservoir of need, and that if she meets his need gladly, that his drive will normalize and become less. But many women look upon their husband's sexual drives as bestial. Well, they do. They think they're sort of beasts. And sometimes if a woman would admire her husband's virility, she would lessen his need to prove it. And if she freely meets his need, she can remove the element of unattainable enticement that increases his need. We work against ourselves in subtle ways when we don't obey God's patterns, as we read in 1 Corinthians 7. And God's pattern is always to do wholeheartedly whatever you do. Women also misunderstand their husband's sexual temptations. They feel utterly crushed if they find out that the man ever looks at another woman or thinks someone else is beautiful or has a real sexual temptation. And actually, men can love their wives with all their hearts and still be tempted and still find other women attractive. I find other women attractive, beautiful. Maybe I'm not tempted like a man is, but a red-blooded, virile man is going to face temptation sexually, and an understanding wife in whom he can confide without her getting totally frustrated can help him. Half the battle can be won. I had the man that performed my first wedding, a wonderful man that I admire greatly, a Christian leader, told us that when he leaves for a long trip, he'll tell his wife, "Margaret, pray for me that I will not be taken in by sexual temptation," and Margaret prays for him. And he has not been taken in by sexual temptation. He's never admitted it to me. But, you know, it helps to realize that this is just normal. And an understanding wife, especially one who prays for her husband, can prevent the temptation. They say you can't prevent the birds from flying over your head, but you can keep them from making a nest in your hair. And some women are disillusioned from an entirely different angle, because either all their marriage or in a certain periods of their marriage, their husband's sex drive is less than theirs. And he faces impotence to one degree or another. And this seems totally unusual to the wife, and she doubts his basic virility. And this is not an unusual thing at all. One doctor reports that every man at one time or another in his life has some malfunction of his sexual apparatus. And he goes on to say that chronic or repeated impotence probably affects about 30 to 40% of men at any given time. So don't think just because your husband's drive isn't always what you thought a man should be, that there's something basically wrong with him. Actually, the underlying cause is usually a deep anxiety, which may be related to the sexual act, or it may be related to other problems in the marriage relationship, or it may be related to anxiety or pressures at work in some given period where he's totally preoccupied with these things, and such problems are not abnormal. And then I'd like to recommend to you an article in the February Reader's Digest this year about why husbands cheat on their wives. And it's very interesting. It shows that a man's sexual response also is rooted in the emotional tone of the marriage. And men who are unfaithful to their wives usually give emotional causes. And sexual dissatisfaction is not often a basic part. And so the things we have been considering month by month can help to keep a man faithful by meeting his deep emotional needs. And by the way, when there were sexual complaints recorded from wandering husbands, it wasn't that they wanted a siren, someone with exotic techniques or something. It was just lack of loving availability. Ability means far less than availability in satisfying a man sexually. Now, there's also a often lack of accurate information regarding the sexual organs and their functions. And incorrect information can cause apprehension and frustration. There's the belief, for one thing, there are several myths that we really have to overcome. And one is the belief that the woman's part is an inactive, passive role of simply letting her husband do something to her. And that's not true. And that there's the belief, to be put it frankly, that the size of a man's penis is important. And this can really frustrate a man, and it can frustrate a woman. She can think, well, I would respond more if. She may go looking for someone else. But the fact is that the woman's sensory nerves in the vagina are located in the relatively near the entrance. And actually, the vagina is a flexible thing. It starts out only about 3.5 inches. Well, that's not very long. It can expand with great comfort to 6 or 8 inches. But it's just a myth that the size of the penis makes a great difference or any difference in the sexual response. There's also the belief that the so-called vaginal climax is more mature than the what they call the clitoral climax, the one that when a woman can learn to come without needing any special stimulation of the clitoris, then she's arrived to a greater maturity of sexual response. And actually, they say that there is not that difference. Women's climaxes vary from one another. I mean, sometimes it'll be a more of a light skimming type of climax. Sometimes it'll be a multiple climax with light skimming, or a multiple climax with some skimming and then a deeper one. Sometimes the deeper ones have, they feel different times. But the fact that that a woman is immature if she needs stimulation of the clitoris is not true. In fact, the way that the sexual organs are built or designed, you cannot have sexual intercourse without stimulation of the clitoris. And it doesn't have to be direct stimulation to be stimulated. Some of the marriage manuals have you try to get into almost impossible, ridiculous positions in order to get the penis to directly stimulate the clitoris. And my husband tried some of them, and they really weren't very comfortable. I found that I didn't need them. And then I read that this is why I didn't need them, because the clitoris has a hood called the prepuce, and it's connected to the minor, to the small lips in the sexual organs. And whenever the penis is thrust in and out, it pulls on the minor, on the small lips, and it pulls the prepuce over the hood and gently stimulates the clitoris. So there's some stimulation of the clitoris in any sexual act. Now, that does not mean it should not be stimulated in foreplay, because they say that about 60% of all women need some direct stimulation in the arousal period, some direct stimulation of the clitoris by the hand, or you can do it by the penis before it's inserted different ways, but most women need some direct stimulation of the clitoris in foreplay before they can really achieve climax. But some women don't. But it doesn't mean that their clitoris is not stimulated or that their orgasm is a more refined, mature one than the other women. You know, it helps to take the time to learn the correct names of the sexual organs. It can help a couple to communicate better about sex. And honest communicating is one of the essentials. And it's also important to learn the inoffensive terms for all the sexual organs and functions, because offensive vocabulary can perpetuate the feeling that sex somehow is a little bit dirty. One of the big problems is unrealistic expectations and goals. The first we have here is expecting instant, full-fledged sexual enjoyment on the honeymoon. The bride and the groom, she has been stimulated quite easily up to this time by just caressing and kissing, and I was sure when they told me that I wouldn't have a climax on the honeymoon, I was sure, on the first night, I was sure that I would. We just sort of chuckled, but I didn't. And people expect that, as they've seen in some movies, you know, that it'll be out of this world and the skyrockets will go off and the earth will move just as soon as they begin to embrace one another on the marital bed. And it rarely happens. In fact, they say that complete sexual success on the wedding night is nearly impossible. And we've talked about this, that the woman's sexual response needs to be cultivated. And another factor is that it takes time for the woman to learn, for the man to learn how his wife feels about sex and what especially stimulates her. And it takes time for him to become a skillful artist in this area. And he will be a little more clumsy, and it'll be harder at first. A man doesn't come ready-built knowing just how to excite his wife. It takes loving communication. It requires a breaking-in period, just like any other intricate operation. It's really easy after you learn how. Some people are scared because they think it's so complicated. They just don't have any talent along that line. It's really easy, but there are some things that you need to learn, and you need a breaking-in period. And if it isn't perfect the second or the 20th or even the 100th time, remember there are thousands of times left for you to go on and improve your performance. And some women who have unrealistic expectations suffer alone, afraid that they're one of the few frigid exceptions. And they feel cheated. And, you know, a woman shouldn't be distressed if at first she finds that she not only lacks sexual response, but maybe she doesn't even like it. It's been said that when you turn on a tap that hasn't been used for years, sometimes at first nothing happens. And then there's a trickle of rusty water, and then an occasional spurt, and then with time, eventually there's a clear, steady flow. And I think that's a good analogy. Another unrealistic expectation is to expect the pinnacle of sensation every time. Got to remember that every human endeavor has limitations and defects, and our sexual acts vary. Sometimes it's all candlelight and romance, and sometimes it's just the hurried meeting of a sexual drive, and sometimes it's laughing and fun. It just varies, and that's part of the fun of it. But it's not abnormal to occasionally miss an orgasm, and it's not abnormal to have periods of times when our climaxes are less frequent or less climactic. And they say that anything that affects a woman emotionally may temporarily interfere with her orgasm and short-circuit her sexual response. This is normal. Another thing we shouldn't expect is unremitting progress toward greater fulfillment. Charlie Shedd, in his book Letters to Karen, says that we're moving towards our sexual goals, and sometimes the pace is slower than we would like it to be. And then occasionally there's a nice leap forward. And then now and then it reaches a plateau. And then it gets moving once more. This is the way growth always is in life, and it's true in the sexual area. There are other unrealistic goals and concerns. Sometimes a man feels that his virility and manliness is threatened if he can't bring his wife to climax. And that's not true. It may be partly that she needs to train her mind to turn on her body. It's very unrealistic to compare our responses with other couples. We are unique, and a wife is unique. We're unique persons in every way, and it just causes frustration to compare. And another unrealistic concern is about being normal. Afraid we're not normal. Or afraid, always over-concerned about what's the normal frequency of having sexual relationships. There is no normal frequency. There's only what's normal for this couple at this period of time. Now, there are various causes of impaired sexual response. And actually, I like to call it that rather than frigidity. I think it's much more realistic. And causes can, impaired sexual response can vary from total sexual revulsion to just the lack of any feeling, or to just occasional feeling, maybe occasional climax, or maybe she gets to the very brink and it's always snatched away. Sexual impairment in one form or another. And first, let's briefly consider physical causes, and actually, it's rarely caused by physical causes. They say that 1 in 1,000 cases are rooted in actual physical incompatibility or disability. And the woman's sexual organs are marvelously designed, and they say they're virtually fail-proof, and that every part has an alternative to fall back on in case something happens to another part, to the first part. And so actual configuration of the sexual organs has very little to do with orgasm. And a physical examination can quickly reveal if we need help from a doctor. Now, our sexual response may be affected by our general physical condition, but a woman in relatively a healthy state should be able to climax. And in a few cases, there may be specific health problems like a hormone deficiency or glandular disturbance, and doctors can find this out and many times can help it. Sometimes the more adequate a woman's diet is, the more she'll be at her peak in her response. We work together as a whole person. But basically, emotional causes are the real root of sexual impairment. These emotional problems can stem from just ignorance or from wrong attitudes, a low view of sex, from feelings of insecurity. We'll look a little more fully into them. Some of the general causes. Sometimes a woman has a deep-seated and general emotional need. caused by serious depriving of emotional satisfaction in her childhood. And sometimes such a woman could profit from a good marriage counselor. Often, it's not that general. A recent article in Reader's Digest, and I really would recommend this to you if you have any trouble reaching climax, in the March issue of 1973, it's called Why Some Women Respond Sexually and Others Don't. And basically, it connects it with the level of confidence that a woman knows in feeling that the persons who are close to her will always be there. A low orgasm woman tends to assume that union with someone will be terminated unexpectedly. And sometimes this is combined with having had an overly permissive father who wasn't concerned enough about her to devote time and energy trying to guide her. And so she has just an unconscious, maybe, distrust of men caused by her father, which she carries over to her husband. And we're going to see that these are things that can be overcome. Sometimes through marriage counseling, sometimes we don't need marriage counseling, but can even overcome them. But there are specific emotional causes. Any negative emotion can hinder a woman's sexual response. And guilt can be a deterrent. Sometimes it may be true guilt for something that she has done. And true guilt can be totally forgiven if we come to Christ. He has provided utter forgiveness. So he forgives us, so it's just as if it never happened. And we do not need to labor on under any load of guilt. It matters not if it seems terrible to us or not. God does not particularly classify one thing as worse than another, and he's longing to forgive any person and gives that wonderful sense of cleansing and forgiveness. And a cleansed conscience is one of those tapes that we're offering if you want to get the cassette of it. It may be false guilt. That doesn't need forgiveness. It just needs facts. Feeling that sex is wrong. And we have to let the message that sex is part of God's perfect plan penetrate deeply into our heart and minds. And false guilt may cause a woman to subconsciously punish herself. Her unconscious mind tells her, this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing this. It's dirty. It's low. It's unbecoming. And so her crime, in quotes, is immediately punished by having no climax. And we need to really let our minds be retrained to see God's viewpoint that sex is beautiful and that he wants us to respond. Another specific emotional cause is hostility. Sometimes it can be general hostility to men in general that's carried over to the husband. But many times it's anger or resentment regarding some particular aspect of our married life. And our bodies become the victims of our resentment. And maybe in the following period we'll be able to cover that a little bit more. But fear and anxiety, fear is maybe the major enemy of a normal sex life. It may be specific fears of pregnancy or interruption or pain or being abnormal or fear of letting ourselves go. We might not be able to pick up the pieces again. And our mind will send down messages. Our conscious mind will say, turn on, let go. And our subconscious mind will say, you may get pregnant. Did you remember your pill today? Or you're not going to be able to climax. You're frigid. Or you're going to disappoint your husband again. Or you're taking all this time and it's just going to be useless. Our unconscious mind sends down those messages and keeps us from climaxing. And fear of failure is often the biggest fear that hinders us. We let it turn into a competitive sport. It's really an uncompetitive sport. And that sexual act sort of becomes an achievement test that we have to struggle not to flunk, and we try so hard that we just work against ourselves. And again, maybe we can consider that a little more in the next period. But there are ways that we cheat ourselves, and right now I'm only going to consider one. That is dissipating our sexual energies in flirtations with other men, in fantasies that are impure, and maybe in affairs, either mentally or actually. And when the sex drive is scattered, it becomes more compulsive and less satisfying, and we diverge the stream of our desire to several avenues, and there's less left to go into the actual sex relationship with our husbands. And God holds us responsible where we direct our sex drives, and he wants us to direct them right to our husbands. It's not wrong to be tempted, but let's take our mind in hand and turn that feeling toward our husband and channel it straight to our partner, and we'll find a new dimension of fulfillment. But you know, we're going to, in the next session, consider some of the ways that we can enhance our sexual relationship more specifically. And there are books, I've recommended books at the end of this, these notes, that can be a great help. But you know, there's something even more satisfying than the sexual relationship. Marriage, including the sexual response, is used as a picture of our spiritual relationship with Christ, in which he, in the Bible, is referred to as the bridegroom. And our union with him is not physical, it's spiritual, in which, in a wonderful way, when we receive him, he comes to live within us, and our spirit is united with him. And it provides a continual intimacy and closeness and security and warmth that just transforms life the more we go on to enjoy our relationship with him. It's a love relationship that surpasses any other. Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." Well, we read later on that God demonstrated his love toward us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners, while we were still resisting letting him be in control of our lives. And God's amazing love, Christ's amazing act of love, has opened up the way for us to have this intimate, satisfying relationship with God. And God's love is far beyond anything that we can imagine in delight and in generosity. We read in Romans that he that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? He's tremendously generous. He wants to enhance every area of life. And C.S. Lewis described the unsurpassable happiness God has designed for us in the next world, but beginning in this world. And he says that the happiness God has designed for his higher creatures is an ecstasy of love and delight in union with him and one another, compared with which the most rapturous relationship between man and woman on this earth is mere milk and water. And last month we saw that God takes the most beautiful relationships of life and he says, "Let me be that to you. Let me be that to you in its perfect ideal form." And we've been talking about the ecstasy of the sexual relationship. It's beyond words, this total inner opening up and release and delight. And as the years pass, it grows deeper and more enjoyable. But I'm sure many of us here can share who have tasted the depths to the degree we're able to now, tasted the depths of both kinds of love, marital sexual love and God's love through Christ. We can say that the second kind surpasses even that in responding to him. It doesn't mean that we're always on cloud nine any more than we are in our earthly relationship. But there's an inner release and delight in adoring and responding to him and cultivating our relationship to him that is beyond words also. And I love this song. I sometimes go over it in my mind after a good sexual act with my husband or other times. And it says, "Jesus, thou joy of loving hearts, thou fount of life, thou light of men, from the best bliss that earth imparts, I turn unfilled to thee again." Now this relationship with Christ begins, like marriage, with one big yes. Receiving Christ is compared to marriage, and the woman says, "I will," to an enduring relationship. And in a good marriage, she says one big yes in marriage when at the wedding day, and then 100 little uh-huhs throughout life. Throughout each day, maybe, as the years go by. And when we say our first big yes to Christ, he comes into our hearts. He's wanting to come in. He comes in. And I have a little booklet back there. I would suggest that maybe, if there are enough, that all of you pick one up. You maybe would want to even share it with a friend. But it's a small little booklet called "Do You Know the Steps to Peace with God?" And it's just very helpful in a little more clearly showing how to take this step of saying yes to Jesus Christ the first time. But then, like any other love relationship, Our relationship with Christ needs to be cultivated day by day, time alone in His presence, reading the Bible, praying, listening to His words of love to us, and moment by moment, depending upon Him, talking to Him, thanking Him, He's living in us. And then availing ourselves of opportunities for fellowship, like today, or like the Bible studies that they have information about, or at your church. The basic fellowship that God has provided is through our church. And through these means, we grow in our love relationship. But it's a union. The union with Christ is one that enhances all of life. It deepens our emotional security, brings increasing release from our negative emotions. And through Christ, we find ourselves plugged in to the one perfect, limitless source of unconditional love. And as our love for Him grows, and as He satisfies us more and more, then His love overflows from our lives into every area of living. And as we cooperate with Him, He works in us and with us and for us.